Harry, could you open us in prayer, please?
Father, we rely on you. We turn to you again this morning and we ask, God, that you would do what you delight to do, to make yourself known to us. We ask that you would take your word and reveal it to us of truths that have been since the creation of time. Change and transform us in the image of your Son, Jesus. And we give him the glory. Amen.
Thank you. All right, that handout, we're not going to get to that right away. That'll be a little later this morning. Thank you, Jake, for doing that. All right, so we're going to be doing 5 weeks in the book of Leviticus, specifically looking at the sacrificial system of Leviticus. So if you're not that familiar with Leviticus, I'd encourage you maybe over the course of this next week to read through it once or twice and sort of get familiar with the layout of it. We'll be focusing primarily on the first 7 chapters, which are the ones that deal with the sacrifices themselves. We're not going to get there today, though, so today's going to be a lot of sort of context leading up to the type of information. My goal with this study is for us to really understand what's going on in the text, because as New Covenant believers, we often skip over all the sacrifice and offering language and just sort of superimpose the work of Christ onto the whole lot of it without sort of trying to understand what was happening at the time. And so I don't want us to forget the New Testament context. I just want to focus on what Leviticus is talking about, what the Old Testament is talking about, before we get there and do some application at the end and sort of tie in these concepts with the New Covenant. So that's my goal. If you have any questions as we're going through, please ask them. I do not guarantee I will have answers, but I will write down the questions and do my best to find the answers. This has been a pretty daunting lesson to begin preparing, because there's a lot here, and it touches on so much of what is happening in the narrative of Scripture, and so there's going to be all sorts of stuff I'm just not going to have answers to, but ask me anyway. I will write the questions down and do my best to get your answers as I can. When you see Leviticus up there, what's your first thought? I mean, we've all read through our Bibles multiple times. I know this isn't a 101 class with new believers who've never read Leviticus. So you guys have all read Leviticus. What are the thoughts that come to mind when you think, oh, we're going to study Leviticus? Is this like, oh man, we're going to get into something?
Rules and regulations.
Rules, okay, yeah, there's lots of rules. And, you know, maybe a question we should ask is, what are they for? Not just what are the rules themselves, but why are they there? Where are they in the narrative of the book? Also a good question to ask as you're reading through. Any other initial thoughts?
Priests and sacrifices.
Pardon me?
Priests and sacrifices.
Yes, priests. Who are the priests? What are they doing? The sacrifices, which of course what we're going to be centering on, is all the different sacrifices. Off the top of your head, what are some of those sacrifices?
Thanksgiving.
Peace offering. Yeah, that's one of them. Robert?
Wave offering.
The wave offering. Yeah, that wasn't sort of its own category. That was, I believe, a category of the peace offering. Waving the brisket in the air, right? It's literally a brisket is what part of the cow they were waving. And that was for the priest to eat, of course. Harry?
For me, it's been the realization of just how bad we are. That we require so many offerings to make atonement, If you look sideways, you've got to make an offering.
Okay. That's a good thought.
Kind of a reality check before you think we're God's chosen.
Right. Right. So even as God's chosen, there was still all these steps that had to be taken. Yeah. These are all good thoughts, and we're going to expand on all of those. I really think that this book is a great source to deepen our appreciation for the work of Christ. As I've been reading through it, it strikes me. Passages that I would have just, glanced over a year ago, I'm reading them and it's describing, something, and you just get this sense of awe and reverence. Because as we come to understand what's going on in the book, like you said, we're realizing not only our moral culpability and our moral reliance on God, but our ritual cleanliness that was required for them to be approached. We're going to make that distinction. There's a difference between a ritual uncleanness and a moral uncleanness. We'll get into that next week. So let's get started. The first thing I want to do is, now, we're used to Jerry Joy doing these, overarching, sweeping narrative things, so I don't have the whiteboard. I can't do the whiteboard. We're just going to go through and do kind of a contextual lead-up. So we believe that Scripture is inspired, and it is given to us for a reason, the way it has been. So what is happening before Leviticus is what we want to be asking. What is the narrative leading up to it, and what is... Why is it we go from that narrative right into the sacrifices at the beginning of Leviticus? So let's start here. All right, we'll wait. So narrative context. Of course, we start with creation of man in God's image. God creates us in his image. That's obviously not the first part of the narrative. God creates everything, right? He creates out of nothing. He creates the universe. He creates the earth, which is, what are the words that... are used to describe the earth after the creation. Yeah. Thinking before that. Formless and void. So God creates the earth and it's formless and void. And then he goes on to organize things, right? He separates the water from the land. And it culminates with the creation of man and woman in his image. So he's creating order out of disorder, chaos. Man disobeys God. We read that in Genesis 3. God gives his law to them, and they disobey him. As a result of this, God promises to destroy the serpent through the seed of the woman. So the serpent who has deceived them is the one who is going to... be judged for this. Also, the man and the woman are given judgments, and they are now, as a result of that, exiled from the garden or the mountain, and cherubim are placed at the east to guard the entrance of the garden, to guard the tree of life. You remember that, right? So there's flaming swords and cherubim guarding the entrance, so they can't go back in. The man and woman who are created in God's image and created to dwell with him and have communion with him are now cast out from his presence eastward out of the garden, and they can now not re-enter that garden. They are cast down from the mountain. Right, we just read in Psalm 24, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? That's a mountain. Who shall ascend the mountain of the Lord? This idea is really important when we're reading the Old Testament narratives. Where are all the idols situated?
On the high places.
The high places. Yep. Why? Right? What are they doing? What are they doing? Putting them on high places.
So they can be seen and worshipped.
So they can be seen, yeah, perhaps. But maybe they're emulating something.
Oh,
they're trying to reattain to something that was lost, right? Man is exiled from the mountain, from the garden. And now he is attempting to reestablish that connection in his own way, which never works, of course. And we read of mankind turning away God in wickedness, except for the righteous going, right? Noah and his descendants. And let's go there. Actually, Genesis 6. Who's got that? 11 and 12.
Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth.
All flesh. So this is, apart from those few, the remnant that God had chosen, this is just the state of man now. Mankind is in a state of rebellion, a state of exile, and a state of wickedness. So the Lord brings judgment as a result. He brings decreation, in a sense, on the earth through the flood. What was the state of the earth again after the Lord created it? It was formless and void, covered in water, right? There was no distinction between land and water. God is decreating the earth, in a sense, and we see what happens at the end of that flood narrative. The mountains rise up, the waters recede, and you get this sort of recreation almost, in a sense. Obviously, the matter is there. God's not recreating the material, but he is reorganizing it, in a sense. So now God has judged the earth. But yet the nations continue to seek a return to Eden. Genesis 11, what's happening in Genesis 11? Yes.
Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel, great. Again, a high place, right? They try and build a tower to the heavens to make a name for themselves. They're trying to return to this state. Again, through earthly means. After this, we read of the calling of Abram. Of course, this is all fresh in our minds, hopefully, from the series we're in. God calls one man out from the nations, which are wicked and in rebellion, right? The nations are in that state. But God calls a man out from the nations and makes a covenant with him. And God promises certain things to Abram, but then this isn't all that he promised him. He promised him the land of Canaan as his inheritance forever. What other promises did God make to Abram? Numerous descendants, yes.
Land.
Yeah, there's the land promises, there's the descendant promises.
Kings.
Kings would come from him, right? What else? So we get a man called out from the nations. God makes a covenant with him, and he promises something for the nations through this one man. Right. Salvation is eventually going to go back to the nations through this man and his seed. After this, we see, obviously, there's a lot of history in between these. We're kind of running through. His offspring go into captivity in Egypt. Let's go to Exodus 1. God's made all these promises, and we're three generations past Abraham now, and seemingly the promises haven't been fulfilled. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. So now, like, you start to see, you know, part of that promise is starting to come to bear, right? They're multiplying, but yet they're in slavery. They're not in the land of Canaan. They're still exiled. But God redeems Israel from bondage so that they may serve him. Right, God performs signs and miracles to Pharaoh and the people of Egypt so that they would let his people go, not so that they could just go and continue wandering, but so that they could be his people and go into the desert and serve him, right? God is calling them out so that he may continue to fulfill his promises to Abraham, which was to bring them out of bondage and into the land of Canaan. God delivers the law at Sinai as the basis for their behavior as his people. Again, we've got that mountain imagery, the law being delivered on a mountain. Also happens in the New Testament, by the way, with the Sermon on the Mount. God gives instructions for the tabernacle. So now we're into the story of Exodus. A lot of stuff is happening. And God gives this instruction to Moses on how to build the tabernacle. This is really fascinating. We're going to see a lot of this morning. We're going to get into it. Exodus 25 through 28, and then Exodus 30 are the instructions for how to build the tabernacle. Then, of course, there's a bit of a break with some other narrative, and then they actually construct it. God consecrates the priests to serve in the tabernacle. So he's giving instruction for this place, this tabernacle, and then he sets apart a certain portion of the people of Israel as the ones who would serve him in that place. And that would be Aaron and his sons, right? Part of the tribe of Levi. The people continue to sin, right? They commit adultery after this. After the priests are consecrated, Aaron goes and makes a golden calf for the people, and they worship it. This is after God has already told them not to make any graven images, not to worship other gods, or to liken him to anything. After this, God delivers new tablets of stone and reconfirms the covenant. And then the tabernacle is constructed in Exodus 36 through 39. And they set it up and set it in order. So they get it in place and they start putting all the stuff into it. And all those different things are kind of what we're going to focus on next. There's one more part of this context, which I'm going to save till right at the end of our lesson, which is really going to set up what we see with the sacrifices. Any thoughts on that? So we've got creation, we've got God makes man in his image, man falls, man is exiled from the presence of God, man in their sin continues to seek a reunion with the presence of God, but through evil and wicked means. Through all sorts of evil idolatry, human sacrifices. I mean, this stuff's all over the world. If you watch any of the history and anthropology stuff on YouTube or on TV, you know, you see what happened in South America before Europeans came. The amount of human sacrifice going on down there was something else. But that happened pretty much everywhere. Mankind is trying to reestablish a connection, but they're doing it in the wrong way, and they're doing it, as the New Testament tells us, they were worshiping demons and not the true God. Right? So we've got that whole arc of the story. God calls a very particular people. He makes promises to Abraham that these people would be the ones to restore this relationship between God and the nations, and the Messiah would come through him as a result. And then he saves his people from exile, takes them into the wilderness on their way to the promised land, and gives them the instruction for this tabernacle. And then he sets it up. And then that's when we get to Leviticus. So that's sort of the point of the story we're at that point. Is now the tabernacle is erected, and Leviticus begins. Any thoughts on that? I mean, there's a lot more, obviously, to the narrative than that. It's pretty quick run through. Just a quick note on the word tabernacle. When you're reading in Scripture, you'll see that word tabernacle or tent of meeting. Those are two ways that the Bible translates two different words. And unfortunately, they're not translated the same every time. Sometimes tent of meeting is translated as tabernacle. Sometimes the other word is translated as tabernacle. So it's kind of hard for us, but I'll do my best to parse this out, but the word for tabernacle, mishkan, comes from the word to dwell with. Right? Also, same root as the word Shekinah. We've heard of the Shekinah glory. So that was the cloud and the fire that followed the Israelites as they left Egypt. That was, God's dwelling with his people, in a sense. So the one word for tabernacle comes from that word, the word to dwell with. And the other one, tent of meeting, literally just means tent of meeting. So a tent where God is encountered and approached. All right, let's take a look now at the tabernacle itself. Now, again, the tabernacle generally refers to, if you look at your handouts there, you see the sort of outer wall. That was just a big, tall curtain. When the Bible uses the term tabernacle or tent of meeting, it's usually talking about the inner tent here, not the whole compound. Right? This would be the court of the tabernacle. You see also, it's actually printed this way, but if you want to look at it the way it would have been oriented, I've got the little north, south, east, west way there. That's the way the Lord commanded them to set it up, with the gate facing east. All right, we saw that with the exile from the Garden of Eden. They're exiled from the east. Now as they're approaching from the east back into the tabernacle. Okay, so let's look at some of the components that were in the tabernacle. We'll start, kind of work our way from the gate, the entrance in. So this isn't the order that Scripture presents all these implements to us in, but we're going to kind of go from outward to inward. Exodus 27, 1 to 3, the bronze altar.
And thou shalt make the horns of it upon the four corners thereof. His horns shall be of the same, and thou shalt overlay it with brass, and thou shalt make his pans to receive his ashes, and his shovels, and his basins, and his flesh hooks, and his fire pans, and all the vessels thereof thou shalt make of brass.
All right, so we see this is the first thing you would encounter walking through the gate, is this giant square brass grill, basically, right? If you read the description of it, we've got a square, it's about yay high, it's got four horns on the corner, and it's a grill that will receive ashes below it and beside it, and you would use it for burning fat and flesh. That was the first thing you'd see.
Next, Jeremy,
yes.
So is that an altar of sacrifice on
yes.
your... Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, this was the graphic I got off the internet, so the words went down exactly... match up. The altar of sacrifice is the bronze altar.
Okay.
Or brass. Bronze or brass. Is there a difference between bronze and brass, by the way? I'm not a metal guy. Okay, next we had the bronze basins, or the laver. So this was basically a wash basin. Exodus 30, 18 to 21.
The Lord said to Moses, you shall also make a basin of bronze with its stand of bronze for washing. You shall put it between the tent of meeting and the altar, and you shall put water in it, with which Aaron and his son shall wash their hands and their feet. When they go into the tent of meeting, or when they come near the altar to minister, to burn a food offering to the Lord, they shall wash with water so that they may not die. They shall wash their hands and their feet so that they may not die. It shall be a statute forever to them, even to him and to his offspring throughout their generations.
So they got to wash so that they don't die. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to see in these descriptions and instructions for constructing these items is that there's something going on with this place. Right? This isn't just a tent where you could go and talk to Moses. This is supposedly the dwelling of God. So what does that mean for the dwelling of God? Well, the priests are the only ones who can go into the holy place. And the most holy place, only the high priest. And only once a year. And even they, before they go in, have to be physically clean. Or else it says they will die. So there's this danger associated with nearness to God. And you'll see this as we go through. This is one of the things I believe God was teaching them. It is dangerous to come near me, especially in a state of impurity. And we will see that with a number of the narratives in Leviticus as we go. We think immediately of Nadab and Abihu, right? So there's a danger of approaching Yahweh. The tent of meeting itself. Exodus 26, verse 1.
Moreover, Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twined linen, and blue and purple and scarlet yarn. You shall make them with cherubim, skillfully worked into them.
All right, so this is the covering over the tent. So now you picture you've got the outer court, you've got a tent on the inside. It's covered top and bottom, front and back, with this material that looks like it's pretty fine. It's fine material. It's made with fine twined linen, blue and scarlet yarns, and it's covered in these cherubim. Right? The holy place is guarded by cherubim. They're all around. If you continue to read this description of the tent of meeting or the tabernacle, you'll see that this initial covering is actually covered over by a second covering of goat's hair curtains. So these cherubim that were skillfully worked into this fabric would not have been visible to the people on the outside. It would have been visible from the inside, but not the outside. I mean, I suppose if it was two-way fabric and you could see the pattern on both sides. But there's a possibility this wouldn't have been visible to anyone. But God wanted them to do this. He wanted this fabric to have cherubim on. The lampstand, so now we've moved into the holy place. Exodus 25, 37. This is the menorah, right? What was inside the gate of the garden that the cherubim were guarding? The tree of life, right? The lampstand. Their calyxes and their branches shall be of one piece with it, the whole of it a single piece of hammered work of pure gold. You shall make 7 lamps for it, and the lamps shall be set up so as to give light on the space in front of it. So you walk in, the lamp is on your left, and it's pointing, it's shining its light off to the right. And off to the right, actually before we get there, the oil that would have been used for the lamp, Exodus 27, verse 20.
You shall command the people of Israel that they bring to you the pure beaten olive oil for the light, that a lamp may be regularly set up to burn.
So it had to be a very specific type of fuel, something pure, something finely pressed, right? You couldn't just throw whatever in there that's going to burn. If you've been in the desert and you've seen what people use for fuel in the desert, you wouldn't want to use that sort of stuff for this, right? Anything biological can be used to burn things and cook in the desert. But no, this was had to be pure oil. It was also the anointing oil, Exodus 30, 32 to 33. So if you read the first part, we're not going to read, but it gives the composition of it, right? Myrrh, sweet-smelling cinnamon, aromatic cane, cassia, all of these lovely-smelling things were to be pressed into this oil. And we read in verse 32, it shall not be poured on the body of an ordinary person, and you shall make no other like it in composition. It is holy, and it shall be holy to you. Whoever compounds anything like it, or whoever puts any of it on an outsider, shall be cut off from his people. And this was the most severe form of punishment to the Israelites, being cut off, which was essentially saying, you are, as a Gentile and an unbeliever, right, you are cut off from the people of God. You are part of the unclean nations. So to take this oil that had a holy purpose and use it for something common, or to try and replicate it because you like the smell of it when you were in the compound and you smelled the oil, is a grave, grave sin because of the nature of this oil and what it was used for. So now we have the showbread table, the table for bread, Exodus 25, 28. Or Exodus 25, verse 28, rather. So this is now a cross from the candles, from the candlestick, the menorah, the lampstand. So the lamp is now shining its light on this table.
You shall make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold, and the table shall be carried with ease.
All right, so it's we're getting from brass to more expensive metals here as we get closer. Right? The lampstand was to be made of gold, not brass. The table is to be overlaid with gold, and you're not even supposed to touch it. So you've got to have poles with rings so that you can carry the table without physically defiling it by touching it with your own hands. There was the bread of the presence that was on the table, Exodus 25, verse 30.
You shall set the bread of the presence on the table before me regularly.
So there had to be bread there at all times. And this wasn't like God's going to eat this bread, so we got to leave it here. It's not like putting the cookies out to Santa Claus, right? This is something a little more meaningful than that. But it's called the bread of the presence because it signifies God's presence in this place, right? That's why we've got this sacred space now. It's light, there's food that smells nice, it's a welcoming home, right? Where we're seeing there's something holy about this place, but this is also a place that is homely. Now, if you continue to read the narrative, you see that the showbread's put there every Sabbath, and the priests would have to eat it. So, not on the Sabbath, they would eat it before they set the next batch out, they would eat the bread. And so it wasn't a wasted bread, or it wasn't burned up in a sacrifice like some of the other grain offerings and whatnot, but it was actually eaten by the priests. And so the priests would go in into the presence and eat the bread of the presence, sort of showing their communal, the communal nature of this place. It was the altar of incense. There's a lot of stuff too on that. The table for the bread. There was all sorts of other implements and whatnot, but we don't need to go through those. So there's the altar of incense now, which is before the veil. So inside the holy place, there is this veil separating the most holy place. And this incense is to be burned before, in front of that veil. Let's read that, Exodus 36:9.
And you shall put in front of the veil that is above the ark of the testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is above the testimony, where I will meet with you. And Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it. Every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. And when Aaron sets up the lamps at twilight, he shall burn it, a regular incense offering before the Lord throughout your generations. You shall not offer unauthorized incense on it, or burn an offering, or a grain offering, and you shall not pour a drink offering on it.
All right, so you see this language here, right? Even with the bread, so the bread is placed before me, God saying, place this bread before me. And now we have this incense. You shall put it in front of the veil, where I will meet with you. Right. So this is a sacred space, a sacred meeting place, where the priest would meet with God. And again, we have this sacred nature of it, of the incense. And it gets into the composition of this incense. You could make this incense for yourself, you know. Ooh, I like that mix. Let's go down to the store and make our own incense so we can have this experience at home. I love the smell of this incense. That reminds me of God's presence. Let's go do that at home. No, this was sacred, and anyone who made anything like it was to be cut off. And we see that here in Exodus 30:37-38. And the incense that you shall make according to its composition, you shall not make for yourselves. It shall be for you holy to the Lord. Whoever makes any like it to use as perfume shall be cut off from his people. Everybody's starting to get a feel for this place, right? This tabernacle is not just a tent where they would go and, you know, slaughter some animals every now and then, but this is a very holy space. There was the veil now, which separated the holy from the holiest place, Exodus 26:33.
And you shall hang the veil from the cross, and bring the ark of the testimony in there within the veil. And the veil shall separate for you the holy place from the most holy.
And actually, if we read the verse 31 2, we think we see this, the cherubim imagery. You shall make the veil of blue and purple and scarlet darns and fine twine linen. It shall be made with cherubim skillfully worked into it. Again, we have these cherubim guarding this space. Then there was the ark, which was in the holy place, the holiest place. Exodus 25, 15 through 16.
Staves shall be in the rings of the ark, and they shall not be taken from it. Thou shalt put into the ark the testimony which I shall give thee. And thou shalt make a mercy seat of pure gold.
Oh, that's good.
Sorry, am I wrong one?
Get ahead of me. No, that was right.
Oh.
Yeah, just went too far.
Thank you.
So, getting to the mercy seat. When we think of the ark, we're thinking of the whole thing, right? The box with the cherubim on top. But the ark refers to the actual box itself. It's the mercy seat, which you were just about to read about there, which was on top of the ark and covering the box. So let's read that now. Exodus 25, 21 and 22. And you shall put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony, I will speak with you about all that I give you in commandment for the people of Israel. It is pretty amazing, right? God is giving them these instructions of, if you want to meet with me, here's how you are to construct this place. And again, we tend to read this stuff and go, okay, well, we're in the new covenant, we're believers, I can sort of just go to God whenever I want, and that's true, right? We're to approach boldly, to approach Christ, or the throne boldly, as we offer prayer or thanksgiving. But this was not the way back then. This is not how God ordained his people at this time to meet him. And again, we see this compounding of instructions is meant to teach them something, that it is a serious thing to approach the Lord. And if you want him to dwell among you and to be in your midst, this is what has to happen. There has to be some set-apart place where the Lord can meet you. There were the priestly garments as well, not exactly part of the tabernacle, but part of the sort of whole package. Exodus 28, 1 to 2.
Then bring near to you Aaron, your brother, and his sons with them from among the people of Israel, to serve me as priests, Aaron and Aaron's son, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty.
So the priests can't just show up however they want and go in and do their priestly work. They are to approach in a very specific way as well. And it wasn't just these garments, it was the shoulder coverings, right, with the two onyx stones with six of the tribes on one shoulder and the other six on the other shoulder, and the 12 gemstones on the breastplate with the names of the tribes, and the ephod and the headgear and the linen undergarments. They had to wear all of this stuff in order to approach the Lord. So, I mean, we've already seen what the characteristics of this place are. First off, we make another note that it was oriented eastward. If we look at Exodus 26, verse 22, just speaking of the rear of the tabernacle. And for the rear of the tabernacle, westward, you shall make six frames. So the back of that tent of meeting, the back of the tabernacle was to be facing west, which means the gate is facing east. And so mankind was exiled from the garden eastward and is to return in the opposite direction. They come back towards God, back in his presence, but they're coming back the other way now, back from the east to the west into the presence of God.
Jeremy, I just think that's fascinating. Like, you know, reading through this, I probably never would have recognize that, like being expelled to the east and then coming back and how it's set up. And just the, and I know we'll probably get more from this, even the way the Lord has set this up, even making application to us today. But yeah, this is so helpful and enlightening as we're reading through it.
And that's not the end of that sort of east-west language. Is it in Ezekiel where it speaks of the Spirit of the Lord leaving the temple before the destruction? Mm. It leaves eastward. The Spirit goes out eastward. Uh-huh. And then you have Christ returning to the temple, coming from the east, coming into Jerusalem, coming up to the temple. Anyway, there's all sorts of imagery which is really, really great. It helps us understand what's going on. The tabernacle was to be a place of beauty, right? So the God of beauty, the God who has created the world, which is full of beauty, His tabernacle, his dwelling, ought to be a place of beauty. We already read this. The priestly, the curtains are to be fine twined linen, and blue and purple and scarlet yarns. You can see this in the lampstand, how it was to be constructed with the little almond blossoms for holding the lamps, which have the light, or the mirrors reflecting the light. The priestly garments, which were to be made for beauty. Right? There was something about this place that was supposed to reflect the character of God. Not only his holiness, but his beauty. There's a place of light, Leviticus 24. Let's go there. I mean, when you get home, what do? You turn the lights off, right? It's showing that there's someone dwelling there. I know we've all gone into homes that feel cold and empty, and it's really sad, especially in my work. I get to go to lots of people's houses. Sometimes you go to a house and it's full of light, and somebody's making bread, and there's laughter, and there's, you know what I mean? There's a sense of presence there, and other places don't have that. And God's place, God's dwelling, was supposed to have this sense. Now, Leviticus 24, 1-4, who's got that?
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the people of Israel to bring you pure oil from beaten olives for the lamp, that a light may be kept burning regularly. Outside the veil of the testimony, in the tent of meeting, Aaron shall arrange it from evening to morning before the Lord regularly. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations. He shall arrange the lamps on the lampstand of pure gold before the Lord regularly.
All right, so he is to go in day and morning and night, and light these lamps. Keep them going all the time. Right? They're supposed to be light. Now it says Aaron's supposed to do it, but I think we all understand that Aaron died and this was supposed to be continued on by his family. Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. The tabernacle is a place of light, or a life. Leviticus 24, 8-9. Every Sabbath day, Aaron shall arrange it before the Lord regularly. This is the showbread. It is from the people of Israel as a covenant forever, and it shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in the holy place, since it is for him a most holy portion out of the Lord's food offerings, a perpetual due. Like we associate food with health and life, goodness. Again, like this, having food and sustenance in this place was meant to convey that image. This is a place of life. And a place of holiness. Exodus 26, 31-35. We already read portions of this, but this just really struck me as I was preparing this, the sort of sacred nature of all these articles and how they were rearranged. And you shall make a veil of blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, and fine twined linen. It shall be made with cherubim skillfully worked into it. And you shall hang it on four pillars of acacia wood, overlaid with gold, with hooks of gold on four bases of silver. And you shall hang the veil from the clasps, and bring the ark of the testimony in there, within the veil. And the veil shall separate for you the holy place from the most holy place. You shall put the mercy seat on the ark of the testimony in the most holy place. And you shall set a table outside the veil and a lampstand on the south side of the tabernacle, opposite the table. And you shall put the table on the north side. There's just this sense of awe and set apart this of this tabernacle. And I mean, we have to try and think of what would we like as an Israelite. So God saves you out of Egypt. Now you're in the wilderness. Moses is given instructions for this thing, and he builds it. Well, do I get to go in? Can we go in? No, you can't go in. You can go into the court and do certain sacrifices, which we're going to start reading about next week. But you can't go into the inner part. Only the priests, the sons of Aaron, not even the Levites, only the sons of Aaron can go in there. And then only one of them can go into the holy place. And so we see, there's so many aspects to this, right? There's the fact that the priests are the representatives of the people. They're mediating God's presence to the people through these sacrifices. But there's also this set apartness that I, as a common person, I can only get so close to God. I can go and offer my sacrifices and pray to be accepted. And the scripture, the Levitical sacrifices, give the prescription for how the regular people were to go and cleanse themselves and to have their sins forgiven and to be accepted before the Lord. So we kind of got to get in this mindset. Like, what would that have been like to be living in this type of system? Right? We really take for granted the blessings that we have, being able to approach God. And maybe a little too much, maybe we're a little too flippant about it, not remembering what it cost for God to give us this access to himself. And again, we take it for granted because we, I don't, it's just, we get used to things that God gives us. We start to treat them as things that are due to us, whether or not.
And this was life, day in and day out, yeah. All day long.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you look at, again, if you look at sort of the construction of the camp, the whole camp of the Israelites, I forget where it describes it, but it talks about how the tabernacle is in the center. You've got all of the tribes camped around it, north, south, east, west, facing it. They all have to be facing it. And so this is sort of the center of their life, because God is dwelling in their midst. Oh, I skipped that last one. It's a place of God's dwelling, this tabernacle. Exodus 25:22.
There I will meet you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the Ark of the Testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel.
So if you want to meet God, if you want to speak to him, this, that's the place. And that was the place only one person could go. That's the most holy place. So I hope this is helpful. Bring this with you next week, because as we're going through the sacrifices, it describes all the things that have to be done for each sacrifice. It's good for us to keep this.
I have a question.
There, yeah.
I'm just confused. Is this part the tent of meeting?
Yes.
Or is this part? The outside
the
part.
Whole, this part here. So this is the outer wall.
Yeah.
This is the tent, which was covered with the cherubim and the goat's hair curtains. And then there's a veil separating the inner part of the tent from the outer part of the tent.
But the part that you call the tent of meeting,
yeah,
is the
part.
Inner part?
No.
Or the whole part?
It's the whole tent.
Yeah, okay, got it. Thank you.
The tent of meeting or the tabernacle?
Yeah.
Are the two ways that's referred to.
So it's just occurring to me how, you know, if man has made his own altars, idols before,
yep.
And how there could have been overlap, perhaps, of them going, so here I am banging out this now, instead of I made my own. But the defining thing that I picked up out of it is the significance behind everything God had laid out in like even the detail of the labor for washing and the altar. You know, it says bronze, the overlay is, they refer to it as copper,
yeah.
Which is naturally antiseptic. So this is what they put the altar the sacrifice, this is what the priest washed in. So it was a natural disinfectant. So just the significance behind everything that God so instructed. It's like you just can't wander over into your little joint where you're stuck at an idol, chew some tobacco and spit on the ground and say, make a request now. And this is only, you know, just whenever you felt like it. This is how you are going to do this, and there's a reason behind it. And you just can't come to me, I tell you when, sort of thing.
Yeah, and you see this even before the instructions for the tabernacle, where God tells them, if you're going to build an altar to me, and you want to use stone, you can't dehew the stone. Remember that? You can't use a metalworking tool on this. Right? And again, what's the significance of that? Well, if you look, like, in all these old altars of antiquity, they're all very, you know, masterfully made. But God said, just, you know, pile of rocks, and that's your altar. You can't put your own skill into it, your own workmanship. If it's not made out of just earth, dirt, you have to use stone, and you can't start cutting stone. And that was before this point. And now we see, now it's going to be brass, and it's going to be skillfully made, because it's in the tabernacle. Mm-hmm. Robert, you had a question?
Yeah, it's just a reflection on how lots of places view church these days. You know, like, come as you are. I mean, God, basically, meet God any way you feel like. And when I'm reading this now, like, this east-west thing's really helpful. It's like you come with reverence before God, and that seems to be missing. Like, come as you are. You're here to meet your best friend that you can't see. It's very flippant. Yeah, it's very flippant.
Yeah, and having said that, of course, we do have access. But still, like I said, we allow that access to lull us into a sense of complacency and flippancy. Carrying on just a few more slides here. So, in a sense, we can say, what is the question that is trying to be answered in the book of Leviticus with all these sacrifices? Let's go through a couple points here. The Lord is majestic. Exodus 15:11. Like you, O Lord, this is in Moses' song after the deliverance. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, and doing wonders? And it goes on to describe what God has done in his majesty. So the Lord is majestic, and he cannot dwell with iniquity. Exodus 33.
Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people. When the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. The Lord had said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you. So now take off your ornaments that I may know what to do with you.
God's not saying, I don't want to go with you because I don't like you. He's saying, I can't go with you. You'll be consumed. You are unholy. You are sinners. I cannot be among you. For, you know, to guard his holiness and his glory, but also to guard them from death. I mean, you see what happens when people approach God in an unworthy way. They're consumed. Can man approach God as he is? Exodus 24, 3 through 11. I'm going to be reading this. I'm also doing the Lord's Supper this morning. I'll be reading this as part of that. Verses 3 through 11. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words of the Lord has spoken, we will do. rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain, and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of all the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient." And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." And Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heavens for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. Before they approach, something had to happen before they could go near God. Right? The people had to be cleansed ritually through this sprinkling of the blood. Now here's the question. 2 Chronicles 6:18. This is from Solomon's prayer of the dedication of the temple.
Highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built?
Will God dwell on the earth? That's the question. So we get back to our narrative context. Let's go to the end of Exodus, chapter 40. All this instruction to build the tabernacle, the court, all of these implements. I'm going to read a bit of a lengthy portion. I'm going to start at verse 16 and read to the end of the chapter. This Moses did according to all that the Lord commanded him. So he did. In the first month, in the second year, on the first day of the month, the tabernacle was erected. Moses erected the tabernacle. He laid its bases and set up its frames and put in its poles and raised up its pillars. And he spread the tent over the tabernacle and put the covering of the tent over it, as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he took the testimony and put it into the ark, and put the poles on the ark, and set the mercy seat above on the ark. And he brought the ark into the tabernacle, and set up the veil of the screen, and screened the ark of the testimony, as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he put the table in the tent of meeting, and on the north side of the tabernacle, outside the veil, and arranged the bread on it before the Lord, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He put the lampstand in the tent of meeting, opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle. Set up the lamps before the Lord, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He put the golden altar in the tent of meeting before the veil, and burned fragrant incense on it, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He put in place the screen and the door of the tabernacle, and he set the altar of burnt offering at the entrance of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting, and offered on it the burnt offering and the grain offering, as the Lord had commanded Moses. He set the basin between the tent of meeting and the altar, and put water in it for washing, with which Moses and Aaron and his sons washed their hands and their feet when they went into the tent of meeting. And when they approached the altar, they washed as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he erected the court around the tabernacle and the altar and set up the screen of the gate of the court. So Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tent. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the clouds settled on it. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. This is the lead up to Leviticus, right? All this work to build this tabernacle. And Moses can't even go in. So I just want to leave us with that. We've got this tabernacle built for glory, for beauty, for holiness. But Moses, the chosen prophet of the Lord, is delivered to deliver the law, can't even go in. And we're way over time, so I've got to stop. If you want a head start on next week, maybe start reading verse 7 chapters of Leviticus, the chapters that describe the individual offerings. So I hope this has been helpful, and I look forward to next week. I'll just close in prayer. teach us and to show us who you are. Give us a sense of awe and reverence as we approach you this morning in worship. Help us not to come near with a sense of your obligation to us, but help us to come near with thankful hearts, grateful for what you have done, to allow us to come near to you through the work of your Son.